Welcome to Charge Forward Podcast, where we explore the inspiring stories and voices that are making a difference in our world. I'm your host, James Blasco, and today we have a very special guest with us. Joining us is Linda Johnson, a dedicated advocate and the driving force behind the nonprofit organization Voices for Change, which is dedicated to addressing the treatment of addiction. As the president and founder of Voices for Change, Linda has been at the forefront of the fight against drug addiction, working tirelessly to support individuals and families affected by this crisis. Through her work, she has helped to create pathways to recovery, raise awareness, and influence public policy changes that aim to address the root causes of addiction. In today's episode, we'll delve into Linda's personal journey, the challenges she's encountered, and the impactful work she's doing for Voices of Change. We'll also discuss practical ways we can all contribute to drug addiction and supporting those in recovery. So, without further ado, let's welcome Linda Johnson to the show. How are you doing, Linda?
I'm good, James. How are you?
I'm doing really good. Well, thanks for coming on the show. I know this is an extremely important topic. I know it's really personal to you and your family. So why don't we just get started by telling us a little bit about what Voices for Change is and how you came to found this organization.
Absolutely. So Voices for Change is a nonprofit organization, and our main mission is to help support those suffering from substance use disorder find recovery services, and also to help the families who also need that support. So I started Voices for Change after my personal journey through my son Joseph's addiction issues. We found out that he suffers from substance use disorder in 2011, and he entered his first treatment center. I was just blown away. I didn't understand addiction. There's no addiction in our family background. I really thought he would go to treatment and come out and everything would be better. That's not what happened. And I began this journey of trying to understand addiction and recovery and understanding treatment and how to find it and how to get there. And in 2011, there was not a lot of resources for getting help. So from 2011 to 2013, my son went through several inpatient treatment centers, outpatient treatment centers, recovery centers. Through there, I found families that I would talk to, and they had the same problem. Where do you find good help? How do you find the right rehab for your loved one? Everybody, you know, has different needs while they're in recovery. So I started Voices for Change on Facebook as a Facebook page for families to be able to communicate to each other. So it kind of morphed into a nonprofit. I was speaking with a family and we helped them connect with a treatment provider. And she sent me a check in the mail for $100. And I was like, well, I don't know what I'm going to do with this. I'm not a nonprofit. What do I do with this now? And so I called her up and I said, thank you so much, but we're just, you know, we're not a nonprofit. I can't take donations. And she said to me, Linda, you hold on to that check. I don't care if it takes you 5 years. You're going to do something good with this money and I want to be part of it. So you just hold on to it. So I talked with my husband and we decided that maybe we needed to form some type of a nonprofit. We didn't really know what that meant or where it was going to go or what we should even do with the funds. And it just kind of happened. And then we decided what were our struggles, what was my son's struggles, and where could we take these funds to help families or individuals. And that's kind of how it started. And it took us a while to kind of figure out the mission, right, and the vision of where we wanted to go. So that was probably one of our struggles early on.
Yeah, so it's interesting. You know, I talk to a lot of business owners, entrepreneurs, athletes, people who tend to have a vision for what they want to do and where they're going to go. And for you, this just kind of came out of the blue. It wasn't something obviously you wanted to be a part of. You didn't even know what it was or how to be a part of it. And all of a sudden, here you are. You're kind of in the lead, taking charge of this important mission. What was your mindset? Like, how has that worked for you as you've gone through this journey?
Yeah. So a lot of my thought process was really just focused on where I was, what support I needed, but more importantly, our community what they needed to know. It was kind of all three. So what do I need? What do those suffering need? And what does our community need? Is kind of where it all kind of fell into place. I never thought I would be running a nonprofit ever. I'm work at a bank. I'm a bank manager. I thought that's what I would do until I retired. I still am a branch manager. But being in the nonprofit world, I didn't understand it. I didn't know I was going that way. But I did know that the need was there and the need was great for these resources to be out there.
So with it being such a, you know, a personal situation, I mean, that's what propelled you to do this in the first place. How do you balance the personal and the kind of intimate side of this that is like at the forefront for you versus now, you know, leading an organization that's helping others? I mean, you got to be very strong to do that. So how do you balance those two realities?
So a lot of times for me, it's just staying focused on the mission. And the biggest thing is the family. So when I'm speaking with the families, I see the pain on their faces. I hear the desperation in their voices. And I know I have to stay focused on that family at that moment, and nothing else can stand in the way, because I remember being there. I remember feeling so alone, and I needed someone to hear me. And even if they didn't have an answer, it was somebody I could speak to about these very difficult situations. So I really, every time I talk with a family, I put myself back in their shoes. I remember what it felt like to be so lost and alone and scared for my loved one. And that's how I have to stay focused in order to stay. It's such a hard thing, I guess, because it's so emotional and it can be very draining. So I always keep my focus on, I remember what it felt like, but I also remember how comforting it felt for someone to listen to me and hear me and tell me it was. The decision I just made is okay, because we make some hard decisions in handling this. And sometimes we feel really hurt and sad and we beat ourselves up. And it's nice for someone to say, it's okay, Linda. It's okay that you said no. It's okay you did that. And I share with my families a lot to be okay with their decisions, because they have to be able to be okay with it. Because I always thought to myself, you need to be able to put your head down on the pillow tonight and go to sleep. So you have to be okay with the decision you just made. And letting somebody hear that message is very comforting.
There's a lot of conversation that I have with athletes and sales professionals and people that are, you know, high level professions and intense professions. And we talk about mental toughness, and you know what it takes to stay focused and those types of things. Could you shed a little bit of light onto what mental toughness means for you as you had to, you know, work through those circumstances and then, you know, grow a nonprofit out of it? I mean, what does mental toughness mean to you?
So if I had to think of mental toughness when it came to my son's addiction and the things that I had to do, I always had to remember that the decisions I made had to be in Joe's best interest, right? So I'll give you an example of a really tough decision to make. At the end of probably his run of addiction, he was living on the streets, and he would call and ask for money. And obviously I didn't give him money, but sometimes he would ask for food. Can you just bring me food? And I would. And at the end, I had to really tell him, you know what, Joe, I love you enough that I can't bring you food tonight. And the reason I can't is because I don't want you out in the streets any longer than you have to be. I need you to go get treatment. I need you to find help. And if I make you comfortable, you stay out there one more day. So the hard part is saying to your child, no, I'm not bringing you food, right? That's horrible. It's heart-wrenching. But I knew it was the best thing for him. So the decision wasn't what's going to make me feel okay. It's what's going to be the best in the best interest of my son. And I was able to get through those tough times by understanding that the decisions I made had to be in the best interest for Joe. They had to allow him the ability to get up and find his way to treatment without me doing it for him. And that's how I have to stay focused when it comes to doing my nonprofit. Like, what is the best interest of those around me? And sometimes the decisions I have to make aren't easy ones, but the outcome is to make the individual stronger, to help them find healing, to help the family find healing, to help the individual find recovery. And then I needed the support, because after I would have to make these hard decisions, I needed somebody to talk to. And that's where me going to a support group helped me be okay with the decisions I just had to make, which were very difficult ones to do.
Yeah. It's amazing, you know, for you to be able to not just deal with that, but navigate it, cope with it, and, you know, find others to lean on, but then also have others lean on you. That's amazing. In addition to Voices for Change, I know you're involved with a lot of different organizations. Just to name a few, you're on it with a Drug and Alcohol Advisory Board, the Colby Academy, the Opioid Awareness Task Force. So do you feel like you've been thrust into leadership? I know you're in management and banking and so forth, and you were a leader there and you're still a leader there, but how does it feel to be thrust into leadership? Like, when you weren't even looking for it, and now people are looking up to you, like, Linda's the one. If you want answers, that's who you go to.
So overwhelming sometimes. So they all kind of fell into place. They just kind of were there. So what happened was, once I started the nonprofit, I decided that if I was going to do this, I needed to be involved in the community. So again, I started the nonprofit in 2017, and more talk was in our communities about addiction. So you started hearing about these events. There was a lot of talk about overdose, and, you know, we were losing a lot of young people to the disease of addiction. And more schools were talking about it, and there was more events. So I started making sure if there was an event going on, I was there. I had my table there, I had information there, and I was going to share. And through that, these other things kind of developed. So the Easton Opioid Task Force, which is still around, they're not as active as they were at the time. They approached me and said, hey, can you sit on the committee with us? We'd love to hear your thoughts. We know that you have resources out there. Colby Academy was a recovery high school, which we could do another whole podcast on. it's not in existence anymore. But that was, again, being out in the public, and they were starting the school, and they asked me to sit on the board. And I learned so much from being on that board for 4 years. So there was a lot of different organizations that, just from being out in the community, they asked me to share my experiences. And I gladly accepted, even though at times I felt like I chewed off more than I could do. But I just felt it was so important to be a part of it, because there's a lot of shame and stigma around addiction. So not everyone's willing to stand up and put it all out there. But I wanted to, because if we're, as a community, as a country, if we're going to heal from something, we have to be out there talking about it. We got to talk about the hard things. We got to talk about the ugly side of it. We have to talk about all of it, because we don't make a change if we're not talking about it.
So speaking of community and stigma and politics and all this stuff, what is the sense you get from the community as it relates to this crisis? Are people now more on board and aware and educated, or are we still lagging behind in just, you know, our thoughts and understanding of this situation?
I believe that we're getting closer. There's definitely a lot more understanding of it now than in 2011. It's sad it took hundreds of thousands of people to die before our country and our community said, hey, enough is enough. But I think people are starting to understand that it is a disease and that it's not a moral failing. We've broken through some of that barriers of shame and stigma, but it's still there. And I'm a strong believer in, if we're going to break that barrier down, we need more people to stand up and tell their stories. We need more people to share, even if it's their losses or if it's their celebration of their loved one in recovery, we need to share that, because nothing changes if we don't speak out. And, you know, there's a lot of misconceptions around addiction that I think we're breaking through. But it takes everybody to be playing in that game. And one of the things I notice when we go to these events, these awareness events that are in the schools and in their communities, we tend to get a lot of people who are already dealing with addiction or they dealt with addiction. What we don't get a lot is the families who think it can't happen to them because they think my child would never do that, or I don't have addiction in my family, so it can't happen to me. And I want people to understand it can happen, because addiction is a disease. And the way I look at it, if it was the alcohol or the pills or the drugs that caused addiction, everybody who drank would become an alcoholic. And that's not the case. It's not the alcohol. It's not the pills. It's not the drugs. It's the chemical makeup of the person. So you don't know whether your child suffers from that. You don't know if they pick up that drink at 21 that they don't become an alcoholic. There's so much chemical makeup that puts that out there, because a lot of people say it's a choice. It was their choice to pick it up, but it really wasn't. Once they picked it up, the choice kind of went away. And the research that's been out there is that they need to go to treatment to find their way to recovery. They can't just stop. And there's a whole lot that goes on into the whole different types of drugs and all of that. But we're very close to breaking through those barriers, but I don't know if they'll ever go away. I think there'll always be that shame and stigma. And the shame and stigma is what keeps people from getting help. It's what stops the families from reaching out because they're afraid of what people might say. It's what stops the addict from going to treatment because of the shame and stigma. So the very thing we need to break through is the biggest thing that impacts people getting help.
Yeah. I mean, in this day and age when, you know, therapy is available to just about everybody, I think that stigma is kind of lessened a little bit. People are more aware that they could seek help for different things. You know, I wonder, you know, what you think about folks' ability to reach out on their own to get that help, or how much of it still is somebody else kind of dragging them to get that help and kind of keeping them in that situation to improve.
So I do believe that individuals, they will reach out for help. I do think when the families or the other family units are enabling, it impacts their ability to reach out. So again, I'm doing for them, I'm giving to them, I'm making them comfortable in this state of addiction they're in, why would they get better? Right there. It's scary to go to inpatient. It's scary to ask for help. So I feel like individuals are more apt to reach out for help when we've stopped enabling that behavior and we stand there and say things like, I love you enough that I'm going to help you find treatment. I love you enough that I can't do that for you right now. Because the old saying, rock bottom, there comes a point where they're just so uncomfortable where they're at that they go get help. And I'm not saying putting them in a car and dropping them off at a rehab isn't a bad idea, but it usually doesn't work. They have to want to do it. They have to want to get better. And for my son, our situation, it wasn't until Joe decided he was going to get better that Joe got better. It wasn't me taking him to rehab. It wasn't any of those things. But I do believe that when I got help and I was able to be the support he needed and not the enabling mom that I was, it gave him the ability to go get help. And it's the same with the families. I speak at a lot of rehabs and I speak to the families. And one of my messages to them is that they deserve to be, have peace in their lives. They deserve to have a life and they deserve to heal. And the family unit can't heal until everybody heals. I've always said, if my son found recovery and I didn't heal from my journey and I didn't learn how to change my behaviors, I would have still been very, not toxic, but it would have impacted Joe's recovery, right? Because I would have been nosing in things I shouldn't have been nosing in. I would have been putting myself in places I didn't belong. So he has his path and journey and I have mine. And if those two paths cross, it's just not a good thing. And I teach families how to stay on their path of recovery and their loved one on their path. And that's where it stays healthy, because now I know my boundaries. Joe knows my boundaries. I understand what's mine to control and what's not mine to control. And I have to take a look at me and change me, because I can't change Joe.
Right. And so on the flip side, once, you know, you have the individual who does want that change, the family wants that change, and they're moving down their paths and things are, there has to be some great success stories, some things that have come out of this that you just say, wow, it is amazing. It can happen. And here are some of those results.
Oh my gosh, hundreds. So I see both sides. So I could tell you millions of wonderful recovery stories where the families really were, they're never going to make it. He's never going to find recovery. And all of a sudden there's recovery. It's just, they woke up and they were where they wanted to be and they went and they got help and they did everything they were supposed to do. I also see the families whose loved ones didn't make it. And I feel my heart is so heavy for them for two reasons. They lost a loved one. They lost a son or a daughter or a husband or a wife. And not only that, but they lost them through this hideous thing called addiction, where some people still say, well, they deserved it. They, you know, were doing drugs. They had a choice. They could have stopped. So now you have this pain from losing someone, and then somebody says something to you in that effect, the impact it has. So the shame and stigma really hurts even the loved ones who are trying to deal with the loss of their loved one. So we have this event every August 31st. August 31st is International Overdose Awareness Day. And for 10 years, we've been having an event in Bethlehem where we dedicate the night to the families who've lost someone. And I started out at a little park in Forks Township, and then it ended up at City Hall in Bethlehem for a couple years. And now we have it at the big stage at Steel Stacks, which is a huge event where they put on lots of festivals every year. They approached me and said, hey, we believe in what you're doing. We want to support the families. And for the last 7 years, they've allowed us to be on their big stage and have these events. We do a candlelight visual. We do a slideshow. And it's a moment in time, that one day where the shame and stigma goes away and people gather and we show their faces. We show the world these lovely people that lost their lives. And what we're telling the family is we're here for you and we'll always remember your loved one. And it breaks that barrier down. And then they also allowed us to do this whole banner scene where you can submit a picture and they hang the banners on the fencing all around the Arts Quest building. So anybody walking through town, through the Arts Quest area, will see these banners on the fencing. What a great way to break down the stigma, right? We're throwing it all out there. And it's amazing how much the families appreciate that one night, that 2 hours of time where we remember their loved one. And we always have somebody share their story of recovery, right? To all the families out there still watching their loved ones suffer, we give them hope. We say recovery is possible. And then we provide the resources to do that.
That sounds very, very special. And it's a real tribute to you and the organization that it's gotten that far and impacted the community so much. So as we wrap up, what advice could you possibly give to somebody who is thrust into a situation like yours and decides that they too want to make a bigger, broader impact on a community? What advice could you give these folks?
Not to be afraid. If you're passionate about something and you understand that your story is going to help others and make a difference in your community, then don't be afraid to stand up and share that story. And don't be afraid because you don't even know how to start a nonprofit. Just go ask another nonprofit. That's what I did. I just found some other nonprofits and said, how did you do this? What do I have to do? And they helped me do it. And I asked a lot of people, like, what do you think we need out there? So people are willing to share. Other nonprofits, other businesses, other families, they're all willing to share their experiences. I call it sharing our experience, strength, and hope, right? So we have all of this in our lives. And if I don't give it back, it means nothing. So for everyone who gave to me, this was my opportunity to give back.
So if folks have a loved one that they're concerned about, they need some help, where can they reach out? What should they do? The first step.
So the first step, if you have a loved one that's suffering from the disease of addiction, you need to find support for you. And you can probably, depending on your community, they have, every county probably has a number, a 1-800 number that you can call. But there's a couple family organizations that are national, worldwide, actually. You have Al-Anon, which is the support group for families with loved ones suffering from alcoholism. And we have Naranon, which is a family support group for any loved ones suffering from any type of substance abuse disorder. And to me, that should be your first call to a meeting. And I remember the first time I walked in, I had been in my son's journey for about 4 years. And I walked in and this woman came up to me and she's like, I bet you need a hug. She has no idea the power behind those words, because I needed a hug that lasted for about 2 hours. But that hug broke down the barrier for me to be able to sit at the table that night and pour my heart out. And everyone there was so supportive. And I remember leaving thinking, I can't wait to come back next week. And I didn't want to go there. Believe me, I did not want to share my experiences with anybody. But if you have a loved one that's suffering, you need support, that's where you need to go. And your loved one will get better when you get better.
That's a really powerful message. And I want to thank you for being on a show. I know this is really challenging topic. You've handled it amazingly with tons of grace and strength. And for those of you out there, if you want to know more about Linda, her organization, voicesforchange.com, you'll learn a bunch there. I'm sure if you reach out to Linda, she'll be happy to speak with you. And we just appreciate you being on the show. We have more really compelling, inspiring stories to come on this podcast, Charge Forward podcast and chargeforward.com. Thank you for your time.